Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and today we're a very special opportunity to get to talk with Dr. Angela Franks, who is a professor of theology at St. John's Seminary in Boston, and a well-known speaker and author. As a matter of fact, a speaker much in demand, and we're just delighted that she's out here in Southern California doing some speaking for us and for some related apostolates here. Dr. Franks, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You teach at a seminary.
That's right.
But you're known for theology of the body, all that kind of thing.
Yeah,
how's that go over there at the seminary?
Oh, they're very... They want that kind of material. They recognize that the seminarians recognize that there are real cultural problems. They feel a little bit inadequate to meet them, and they know that they have to up their game, and so they're actually very eager to take those classes.
I hadn't thought of that, but that makes perfect sense. If you're a priest, you're going to deal with every kind of question relating to the body. And there's a lot of them
these days.
And you better have something to come back with. Okay, well, I want to talk with you about a phrase that I began to hear a few years ago. The phrase is sex positivity. And the way that it's presented, at least in my understanding, in various, you know, where people write or blog or do it or podcast, that kind of thing, is a basic cultural idea that you can have a positive view of sex, but this positive view, it seems to me that it's primarily libertine, that it's positive in the sense of do what you want and have no hangups. Are you familiar with this term and that and the spirit of the thing?
Yeah, I'm familiar with it as a subset of feminism. And I think in feminism, it was probably a reaction to 60s, 70s, 80s feminism that maybe tended a little lesbian and tended to be kind of anti-male and maybe sort of anti-sex. And also, of course, people think they're being very rebellious against the dominant culture when they're being sex positive, even though it's not the case at all. It's the exact opposite.
Yeah, it seems odd that this is thought of as some kind of rebellion against something, but what are you rebelling against? We're 70 years into the sexual revolution now.
Yeah, we have a totally porn-saturated culture, yeah. And so we're not exactly rebelling against anything.
But for example, because this is where I have run into this, is you might write something or say something on the air about pornography, and people will accuse you of not being sex positive, and they'll school you in a more sex positive thing, and you know that you're just bringing a negativity to, and so that is where I encounter it, is that people want to say, well, what's wrong with looking at pornography? Why don't we just have a positive view of sexuality? As a Catholic, I think, well, that's not a positive view of sexuality.
Exactly, right. It's what it's really claiming is that it's really casual sex positive.
Okay.
In other words,
yes.
Sex outside of marriage positive. And this idea that you can healthily engage in all sorts of sexual activity of various kinds outside of marriage, and that is in and of itself a healthy thing to do. That's the assumption that
right.
You and your questioners do not share, but that's precisely the thing you have to debate. It doesn't end the argument to say, why don't you be more sex positive? It really is beginning it, because then the question is, well, what do you mean by sex and what do you mean by positive? And
right.
That's the conversation to have.
Right. So if you hear a man and woman say we're in a sex positive relationship, then often that's a signal for we're not faithful or we don't faithfulness is not a consideration in this relationship. That seems to me like you said, there's a kind of begging the question or answering the question before you've had the conversation. Is that in fact sex positive, or is that actually destructive of those two partners?
Yeah, there's an assumption in a sense that quantity of sex is an intrinsically good thing. And what I think we know pretty thoroughly from the sexual revolution is that that's just not the case. That especially for women, but this is actually also true of men, the studies indicate, that sex outside of emotionally committed and faithful relationships, that's not a positive experience. That's in fact very much less physically pleasurable, especially to women, but it's also significantly emotionally unsatisfying. And the reason is because I think people who talk about sex positivity ignore the fact that the sexual act or sexual adjacent things make you very vulnerable to someone else. They think that we can sidestep the vulnerability of sex. And that's just a huge error, because once we assume we can act as though sex does not make you vulnerable to another human being, now you're basically setting people up to walk into dangerous situations with people that they don't know very well, that they really shouldn't be trusting based on how much they know them. And we're really encouraging people, especially women, to walk into these vulnerable situations with their guard down. And I think in that sense, it's actually a very negative kind of movement. And it's actually really negative about sex in that sense.
It does seem like that there's a kind of, I mean, an equalizing or an equating of male and female sexuality that is just a fantasy. If you just began with pregnancy, you would see these are not equal or equatable undertakings that a man and a woman engage in. But if you look just at, say, the films of the 1930s and 40s and 50s, there's a game of romance in all these Hollywood films, which actually, to me, suggests something permanent about human nature. And the game is, the man is trying to romance the woman. His desire for sex with her, it doesn't meet an equated partner. It meets a different kind of partner who has different requirements. And so the game has to be played. And even in a body movie, everyone knows you have to play this game because men and women are not the same. It seems to me you couldn't make that movie now because we've destroyed the woman's role in that little drama and that little game that's played.
Yeah, we've told women that it will be fine if you pretend that you can engage in sex like a man does. And that meaning, like a man does, meaning that this is consequence-free sex. Like we've sold this vision, this kind of bill of goods to women of consequence-free sex. So it doesn't work on all kinds of levels. It doesn't work on the physical reproductive level because birth control is not 100% effective, right? And abortion is a really traumatic thing to ask a woman to do. And so this is what my friend Erica Bakiaki calls an asymmetry.
That's what I was looking for.
Exactly.
Asymmetry. Yes.
There's an asymmetrical burden that women just naturally are going to have to bear from the consequence of sex. Like they're the ones who get pregnant. And you can't get rid of that asymmetry. What we've tried to do in the sexual revolution is to use technology to eliminate that asymmetry, but it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And what's in fact happened is that we've made it worse. So we have more unwanted pregnancy. We have there's interesting studies that show that the more adolescents use contraceptives, the more abortions there are in that population.
Yes.
And the reason is because people are engaged in more risky sexual behavior with people who are not committed to them. And so what we have in the net result is more pregnancy, but that's just the physical reproductive side, which is really important. But there's also the whole emotional, social, psychological side, the spiritual side, where people, women especially, but men too, are really being wounded by being used sexually by other people.
Well, as a married man myself and lots of friends who are married men, I think one thing that men know is that at a certain point, the relationship with their spouse is what grew them up, is what got them out of that. We couldn't have done it on our own. We needed a woman to get us out of it. And you maybe think you can do it on your own, or maybe you don't even think it's a problem. It's she who points out to you that permanent adolescence is a problem. but once it's pointed out to you, like I have friends who will say, you know, it was my second year of marriage. My wife told me I had to stop smoking marijuana, that I had to grow up now. Well, okay, though. So it's just the marijuana. But what that is a common experience to all men, that at some point she needs you to be there for her, for children, and that grows the man up. this society we have now, I wonder if there's any mechanism for growing men up. So, I mean, you're talking about the harms to women, but I think the harm to men is permanent adolescence.
That's really well put. I think that's absolutely a problem. And very astute observers have been noticing this. Like, this isn't a secret that we have a problem with men growing up. So the kind of permanent absence from the workplace of a lot of men of working age and all of these problems, the drug use, the, you know, kind of excessive addictive gaming and the pornography, right. Of course, you
right,
know.
Right.
So there are problems. How do we help people to grow out of it? And I think that the bill of goods that men have been sold is that you don't actually need relationships. And part of it, there's more truth to that bill of goods than the first one I mentioned, because precisely because of the contraceptive abortion revolution, it is the case that today a man can get a woman in bed a lot more easily than he could, say, in the 1950s, where
sure.
she could say, no, I'm not going to sleep with you because I don't want to get pregnant.
Right.
And what contraception and abortion did was to take away that defense for women. And so now they feel like they have to play the same game. Maybe they don't want to be, you know, very sexually active, you know, have multiple partners or whatever, but they feel like they have to play this game in order to get a man. And so what we have is that what Mark Regnerus calls the sexual gatekeeping that women used to do and generally want to do because they want the intimacy overall more than the physical sex, that
right.
sexual gatekeeping has been made a lot harder. And so women who do that, like I know many women like this who are wonderful, very marriageable, very, you know, beautiful women, can't get a date or can't find a man who really wants to commit to marriage, right? So there's just all of this fallout here that's impacting both the men and the women negatively. I think the women are sometimes more aware of it than the men.
Well, I don't think men, it's easier to live in an adolescent world and think you're doing just fine, I think. There's a certain thing about, you know, life is an amusement park for the permanently adolescent man. In a way that it can't be for a woman, or it's much harder for that, because I mean, even in the you know, any group of men and women, you'll get the jokes about how women talk more than men do. Well, they're more social. They have men can isolate and in a certain way shut down their social side and actually think they're doing fine when they are not doing fine, but they think they're doing fine.
Yeah, I think that's really true. Yeah, so I think we have a lot of walking wounded. And to get kind of back to your original point about sex positivity, it just ignores all this. It's very unsubtle. It's like really, it wants us to treat sex like eating a good meal or something.
Right.
And, you know, like I just had lunch in the conference room with you and many other colleagues. And like, there's a certain kind of vulnerability to eating with someone, but it's pretty minimal. And they just totally forget how sex is just a completely different kind of act that really requires trust for it to be a good act, not to be virtuous, but also to even just be emotionally and physically good. Like, it requires a certain level of trust. It's not like just snacking at a snack bar.
Right. Okay. So I'm imagining now that priest that takes your classes and goes out to minister. He's going to come face to face with young women who will say to him something like, well, you just want to control women's bodies. And now he's in a position because he doesn't actually want to control women's bodies. But what does he say? What possible thing can a priest respond to a woman who's involved in this ideology of sex positivity? How might he break through that, or can it be broken through?
I think it can be, sure, because I think what came out with the hashtag MeToo stuff about, whatever was it now, 5 years ago or something, a lot of things came out. But one thing that came out is that there's a lot of people who are really unhappy with the sexual status quo. And they might not articulate it very well, but there a lot of women suddenly started saying, you know, I'm really not happy with the sexual dating scene. Like, I'm not happy. And a lot of it, without their really knowing, I think a lot of what they don't like is how porn and porn-like behaviors have crept into that scene. And Right. Yeah, there's just a lot that's kind of dangerous and ugly out there. So I think we can trust that, as is unfortunately always the case, sinful behaviors do not make us happy. And that doesn't mean, it does not mean that people connect the dots. It doesn't mean that they say, oh, the reason I'm not happy is because I'm in my basement all the time, not interacting with humans, or, you know, they don't necessarily figure it out on their own. But I think that's the thing we have to have faith in. And I always encourage the seminarians to focus on what people are saying yes to. Like, along the way, to live a moral life, we have to say no to a lot of things that are bad. And so that's certainly true in the case of sexual ethics. But we're also saying yes to something, right? We're not just simply saying no, 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 you know, no to fornication, no to porn. But why do we say no? Because we're saying yes to love and commitment and beauty. You know, we're saying yes to a lot of things that, for a lot of people, those things are even just fairy tales. Like, it's hard for them to believe it's even true. But I think helping people come to terms with the fact that they're not satisfied, and then recognize that there's good things that you say yes to in living a virtuous life. I think that was always John Paul II's strategy, I think, to emphasize the beauty of truth and goodness, instead of just kind of being like, here's your list of things not to do.
I wonder if this late in the sexual revolution, for a girl, for example, maybe her grandparents were divorced, her parents were divorced, and if this priest says to her, you know, what you want is what you're made for and what will bring happiness to you is a faithful relationship with a man, if she can even, like you said, imagine that that's possible, she may be utterly traumatized against even accepting that that's available, that it could happen.
Yeah, and that's the kind of sensitivity that priests need to have and that lay people need to have to people who are struggling with these issues, who are maybe even like violently opposed to the Catholic position and very angry and so forth. I worked for a long time in the pro-life movement, and one of the things that I learned from that is that when I was dealing with somebody who was so beside themselves with rage and emotion over the pro-life issue, that I was quite likely dealing with somebody who had some sort of abortion experience.
Yeah.
And to just like to always remember that just always really helped me, because it was like it helped me getting sucked into kind of the anger and the back and forth of the argument, and realize like her problem is not what she's saying her problem is, right? And so I think that when we recognize, yeah, we have a lot of broken people around us, we ourselves probably have a lot of these same experiences, and that can help us be more compassionate and help us to identify. So I sometimes tell my students, you know, find the question beneath the question, right? You know, like you have your angry atheistic cousin or something at Thanksgiving who's saying, and the church does this. Well, probably this, whatever it is not the real question. You know, and so it's like, can you find the real hunger, the real question kind of underneath the rest of it?
One thing, when you talk about these marriageable women, I think that pornography has made young men question whether they're marriageable. That is, a young man who's been exposed to pornography since he was 10, 11, 12 years old has developed habits around that, and actually doesn't know, are those habits permanent now? Can he overcome those habits? He doesn't feel marriageable either, but he's not expressing it in the way the woman does.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, this is something we've had to grapple with in the seminary, I think all seminaries, right? Like, you know, we get men who are coming out from the culture, and a lot of them have had exposure to porn or have had problems with porn. And so, yeah, I think it's really important to say that there is healing, like you can rewire your brain.
Yep.
It's hard work. Like it's much better not to need the healing, not to fall into it. But if people do, that there is healing that can happen. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that a lot of men do feel that way. And in fact, you know, despite our sex-saturated culture and so forth, In fact, a lot of sociologists have pointed out we're experiencing what they call a sex deficit, that fewer people are actually engaging in sex. And so part of it is, like, you know, if there's a million naked women available online, you know, like, why bother?
Why do all the social things that I have
to do? Exactly. I might have to buy her a meal or something. Yeah, right,
or have a conversation.
Yeah. Right. So so I think porn explains a lot on the male side. I think on the female side, I think it's a similar thing to the adolescent girl attraction to going trans, to becoming a guy. I think on the female side, you see a lot of women saying, heck with this, right? If this is what sex is all about, I don't want anything to, if it involves choking, and no, thank you. And so they're like, well, what can I do? Oh, I'll take testosterone, so I'll be stronger. Like, I'm not going to be a rape victim. I'm going to be stronger.
Right. So I actually alter my own body to not be the choked partner in the pornographic scenario. So let me put it this way. Is there a sex positive Catholic? Like, do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or is that, would that be an oxymoron?
It's not an oxymoron as long as you're defining your terms, right? So obviously we're not talking about casual sex, like outside of marriage, sexuality. But I think in the Theology of the Body, John Paul II really tried to present sexuality from a different angle, where he was not foregrounding the no's, although he certainly believed that you have to say no to adultery and porn and masturbation and all of that. But instead, he's trying to foregrounding the yes, like the beauty of the sexual relationship. And it certainly is the case that there are some more minor traditions, small t traditions within Christian theology that were not, like, you know, some theologians, you know, back in the patristic era, viewed sex as part of the punishment of the fall. So you do find that in the Christian tradition. It was never embraced by the mainstream tradition.
Oh, but we have those streams.
Yeah, streams. Yeah. And so when John Paul II said, okay, no, like, I'm really here magisterially affirming that God created male and female from the beginning, that it was part of his plan, and that the sexual relationship between them in marriage was created from the beginning as God's plan, and that this relationship that was there from the very beginning, is then perfected and elevated in the relationship of Christ with the church. And so for John Paul II, therefore, the male-female relationship that most ordinarily is expressed in marriage, that's really at the foundation of the salvific plan for God in history, that it has a real salvific purpose. And so it's not just this kind of awkward thing that God did as kind of like a quick fix, like, okay, you guys sinned, all right, let's give this quick fix. You know, it actually was very intentional. And that's a kind of sex positivity that's not this sort of degraded casual sex stuff that you're talking about.
Before I conclude with you, I want to ask you about the social dimension about all of this, because one thing I think about, if you think of sex positivity in this way that we started with, you destabilize society. And even on basic things like men and women no longer know how to interact with one another, because nobody knows who's a potential sex partner and who's not. Whereas in a world where, say, faithfulness in marriage is assumed, there's a kind of relaxation socially, because we're not all on the prowl for everybody all the time. And that's just one way in which that society is more stable, but certainly for children who have the stability of their parents in a relationship. We've talked about the personal consequences, but there are social consequences to getting sex wrong.
Yeah, that's a very important point. I think pretty universally in the pre-modern world, it was understood that marriage is primarily about children, which means that sex is primarily about children. It doesn't mean, obviously, that children come out of every sexual relationship, and certainly not out of every sexual act, but that its trajectory, the whole purpose of it, is to bring a man and a woman together to procreate a child. And with the sexual revolution, you have this shift where sex is now supposed to be about adults and adults only. And this manifests itself in very weird ways. Like, there was just something recently, there's some academic paper that argued that, quote unquote, trans men. So this means women who identify as men who are on testosterone. It has happened that sometimes these women get pregnant. And this paper argued that women who are taking testosterone should continue to take it, even though it would have serious effects on the developing baby, because it's just more important that this person, this adult, be able to affirm. It would be too traumatic for this person not to affirm her chosen gender identity. And that's just one kind of bizarro sort of example of how we've reframed sex to be about adults, which means that they're so Helen Alvarez has been complaining about this for a long time, that U.S. family law is about the adults. And it neglects too often the children. And that's because we think, because of the sexual revolution, that sex is about adult recreation. It is not about family procreation. So yeah, I think it's had a huge social impact, negative.
If family law is about adults, then children are utterly defenseless.
Right.
There's no one left to defend them.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's
sorry to end on that note.
That's not sex positive, though.
I mean, right,
that's
exactly.
That's a disintegration of what should be integrated. The mother should be about the child. The father should be about the child. That not even on a supernatural, on a natural level,
exactly.
That's what we are.
That's healthy humanity.
And somehow we've broken that healthy bond. Yeah. Dr. Angela Franks, I really appreciate you talking about this, because we do. It's odd how many comments we'll get if we come across as stern about pornography or about sexual issues. There's a very strong pushback these days. There's a real strong pushback that somehow that's oppressive or enslaving our view. And I appreciate you having the intellectual heft to provide some basis for what I've emotionally believe, which is no, that's not enslaving, that's liberating, that's freedom. The Christian approach to sexuality.
Amen. Happy to affirm you, Sai.
That's the main thing. It's about me. That's the main thing. Dr. Angela Franks has been our guest. She doesn't do a huge amount of speaking, so when she's around, you should come hear her. She's very, very good. And if you're going to seminary and you want a great professor, then go to St. John's Seminary in Boston. I don't know what it means that you're a senior fellow at the Abigail Adams Institute.
It's very mysterious.
Really?
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. No, it's a organization near Harvard that serves the Harvard undergrads and kind of providing them with a fuller education.
Oh, how wonderful.
It is. It really
is. All right. I always think of Abigail Adams as don't forget the ladies.
Is
that what she said?
Yes.
Don't neglect the ladies?
Yeah. And Abigail Adams has the Wollstonecraft Project, which is run by my friend Erica Bakiaki, which focuses on providing education on sex and gender in a really humanistic, kind of healthy way. So check it out if you're interested.
Thank you for checking us out here at Catholic Answers Focus. As always, if you'd like to support us financially, it takes a few dollars to keep the lights on, and you can provide that at givecatholic.com. If you want to communicate with us, send us an email, focus@catholic.com. You can comment on this episode, maybe suggest a future episode. And if wherever you're listening, if you would give us those 5 stars and give us a review, that helps to grow the podcast, and we would appreciate your help in that. Once again, I'm Sai Kelly, your host. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.